Good morning. The impact of climate change and the failure of international politics dominated the airwaves this week. There was much focus on Irish peacekeepers holding the line in an increasingly volatile environment in Lebanon, as Israeli tanks were positioned close to Irish soldiers.
Efforts are being made by UN headquarters in New York to get the Israeli troops to move from the area because they compromised the safety of the peacekeepers, according to a spokesperson for the UN interim force in Lebanon, UNIFIL. UNIFIL monitor the Blue Line, the 120-kilometre demarcation line drawn by the UN to which Israeli forces withdrew to when they left South Lebanon in the year 2000. We're joined now by Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, who is a spokesperson for the Israeli Defence Forces. Good morning.
Good morning.
Did the IDF ask those UNIFIL troops who are based in Post 652 to leave their post to allow you to target Hezbollah?
We have been conducting over the last 6 days now ground operations, and indeed we had conveyed for the safety of the peacekeepers that we asked them to move out of those locations for their own safety.
The UN has decided that to move them would be more dangerous than for them to stay in place. Will the IDF move as you have been requested to do by the UN?
No, we are focused on our operations against Hezbollah and their positions. There is combat happening across the frontier, across the border, in many areas, and we'll continue our operations, and we'll have to operate with understanding that there are United Nations forces, peacekeepers there, and that's what we will continue to do.
On Liveline, families of soldiers serving in Lebanon told Joe of their fears and worries as the standoff continued.
Caroline, good afternoon, Caroline.
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Good. I know you're at your wit's end. It's your nephew who's... He's in that outpost, which is on in a lot of the newspapers today. He's in Lebanon. There's Camp Shamrock. And then I think about an hour away is this outpost where there are 30 of our soldiers. They're effectively trapped and surrounded.
100%, yeah. Yeah. And it's very, very upsetting, so it is.
Okay.
They can't get out. They're constantly in and out of bunkers. When they do get out of bunkers, we do get a little message saying we're okay. We're begging the Irish government, please, do whatever you can, get them out of that outpost.
Explain the blue tick to me, Caroline. Okay, we're used to calling them the blue helmets. The blue tick, you live for that little blue tick on the WhatsApp.
Right. So I'm in a little group.
Yeah.
And in this little group, it's all positive. And we're just letting each other know, yeah, they're online. There's 30 of them in that little camp. 30 of them. And then you have that big, huge tank looking in at them. That's intimidation. And it's frightening.
And
then we have air kids telling us, we're all right, don't be worrying about us. They don't think that we know what we're saying.
Amid high-level diplomatic engagements, Israeli tanks withdrew from their position around the Irish post. Yet despite this, the situation continued to worsen, as Channel 4 News International editor Lindsay Hilsum told Anya Lawler on Morning Ireland on Friday.
You arrived in Beirut yesterday. Only 16 people, I think, on your plane, and the smell of smoke over the city as soon as you arrived.
As we landed just before, there had been 4 attacks by the Israelis in the centre of Beirut, so we could smell it as we got off the plane and as I came to the hotel. Apparently, they were targeting a senior Hezbollah official. He, according to Hezbollah, was not killed. But what the health ministry here are saying is that 22 other people were killed.
And the head of the UN mission there, the UNIFIL mission there, told the Security Council last night that UNIFIL troops in Lebanon are increasingly in jeopardy, that operational activities have virtually come to a halt since the 23rd of September. And then we had these 2 incidents yesterday of firing on UNIFIL troops by the IDF. Is this a deliberate tactic to push UNIFIL out of the area? Is this a deliberate tactic to avoid eyes on what's happening in South Lebanon?
Well, clearly, the Israelis have said to UNIFIL that they should withdraw. And when UNIFIL refused to do that, first of all, they shot out the cameras on the Nakura Tower, which is an observation post. And then they fired at that base, and 2 Indonesian UNIFIL soldiers were injured. So Israel isn't being secretive about what it wants, which is it says that UNIFIL should withdraw.
Also on Morning Ireland, Senator Tom Clonan spoke about the current situation in Lebanon based on his military experience and offered this sobering assessment.
So I believe there will be a deterioration in the on the ground in Lebanon. So the Israelis have now moved a fourth division north to the border. They're opening up a second axis of advance. For the Irish troops, this is going to be a very dangerous moment. I know that the Israeli tanks that moved away from 6-52, some commentators welcomed this and felt that it was a signal of greater safety for those troops, but in fact it isn't. It now means that the Israelis can open fire at will on that Irish position because they no longer have troops in proximity. And in the past, the Israelis have shown no distinction, certainly in Gaza, between Palestinians and Hamas. They're showing no distinction between ordinary Lebanese civilians, as we saw in Beirut last night with the killing of 22 people. And they will not draw a distinction between Hezbollah and the UN. So in the past, the Israelis have deliberately targeted UN peacekeepers in general. Now, I've experienced that myself. We've come under direct and indirect fire from the Israelis. But I would say to the families, you know, of troops listening, they are the eyes and ears of the international community, and while they can't stop what Israel is doing, they certainly inhibit them, and it is saving life because not all Lebanese can flee the area. I know from my experience the elderly, disabled, young mothers whose husbands are maybe working in Africa or elsewhere, they can't leave unaccompanied, and you see young women becoming dehydrated, trying to breastfeed their babies. They're in absolute extremis. So they're the people who are stuck behind in the villages, and they're the people that our Irish troops are protecting.
Senator Tom Clonan speaking to Áine Lawler on yesterday's Morning Ireland. Evacuation orders of a different kind were issued in Florida this week as the area braced itself for the impact of Hurricane Milton.
The magnitude of what lies ahead is captured by these local television weather reporters, some of whom struggled with their own emotions as they told their audiences what to expect.
It has dropped. It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologise. This is just horrific.
Yeah, I'm up here by Tampa General. I'm well underwater at 10 to 15 feet. If you see that bridge over there that goes across to the convention center, basically we're talking about water pretty much on the top of that road.
And you can't even overstate this one. This is the real deal times it feels like 10.
If you've got loved ones in Florida or any sort of interest down there, tell your folks to get out of Dodge on this one.
24 hours before Hurricane Milton was due to land, US-based meteorologist Todd Gross was telling Claire Byrne what to expect.
It all depends on a few miles, Claire. I'll tell you the truth. I'll give you the real honest inside scoop. If this hurricane tracks along exactly where it's supposed to, or a few miles north, then this could be one of the worst U.S. catastrophes on record. If it moves a little farther to the south, it won't be a picnic. It'll still be very bad.
So how much time is there between now and landfall?
Exactly 24 hours, almost to the minute. It's amazing that we're having the call right now because it's like the countdown clock has started for 24 hours from now.
Scientists warned that climate change would continue to impact, as climatologist John Sweeney told Claire Byrne.
When we look at Hurricane Milton, we're looking at a hurricane which formed over waters in the western side of the Gulf of Mexico, which are currently about 30 degrees centigrade. Now, that's like stepping into a warm bath.
Can you say that with the oceans saying, we can't absorb any more heat, we're done here, we're taking 90%, we can't take any more, that the consequence of that is increased intensity storms and hurricanes and tornadoes?
Undoubtedly. I mean, the attribution studies that have been done on the Gulf of Mexico have indicated that the temperatures that are being experienced there now are between 400 and 800 times more likely than they would have been if the Earth hadn't been warming up to the same extent.
Climatologist John Sweeney. Also on Today with Claire Byrne this week, Education Minister Norma Foley was asked about electronic pouches being funded in schools to help limit students' access to smartphones and social media. This is some of what she had to say.
I would be the first to say that when I would hear the figure that's being invested, I would say,
million.
Wow, That's a lot of money. And I would be the first one to say that. But when you break it down, when you tease it out, that's actually 20 euro for each student that's in our care, 400,000 students at post-primary.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Simon Harris said the schools wouldn't have to spend it on the mobile phone pouches. So what can they do with it?
No, well, what, this is specifically, you know, I think what the Taoiseach said there is that the school didn't want it, they didn't have to take it up.
Right, but they can't apply to use it for something else. They can't do that.
Specifically for this funding. And why are we doing it? I think it's very important as well that we actually get to the root of that. All of the studies, all of the research, whether nationally or internationally, all of the studies are telling us that, for example, UNESCO are telling us that schools should completely and utterly ban the mobile phones. Mm-hmm. And I did actually announce that previously, and this is a resource to support it. They tell us, for example, as the student waits to hear the ping of their phone, their learning is interrupted and it takes them 20 minutes to re-engage into their study, as it were.
And speaking of social media, breakout star Garen Noon spoke to Ray D'Arcy after his Late Late Show appearance, and he didn't arrive empty-handed.
Yeah. I've got a bit gourmet for you here. This is a smoked salmon gratin. Now just watch the toothpick that's there for aesthetics.
So the potatoes, smoked salmon on top, then what is it? Creme
fraiche? See if you can guess the herbs.
Right, Jeannie Mackers, it's falling apart here. Now, there's a problem. People don't like listening to people.
Okay, sorry.
On radio.
I'll give a bit of dialogue there while you're eating. Yeah. So he's just enjoying my lovely culinary delight there. I'm just going to keep you company. Well, he seems to be enjoying it anyway.
There's a, on top, at the very top, we start at the top, there's dill.
Yeah.
And then there's some grated lemon rind or whatever you call it.
Yes, of course, that bit of brightness.
Yeah, zest of lemon, is that what they call it? Then there's smoked salmon, and then there's potato gratin, which is, it's all lovely. It all works perfectly.
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't make it. I didn't make it. There's a bake-off going on here today.
Right.
So I just got off the train from Mayo. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to be able to bring any food. And they were like, just pretend you made this. It'll make you seem really cultured.
That's Mark's then.
Yes.
Mark.
So, Mark, you've done an excellent job with that salmon gratin.
One of the offers you're getting over and over again is to say happy birthday to various people.
Yes.
Yeah, and just say hello to people and congratulate them on various things. And I know there's an organisation or a website in the UK called Cameo, mm-hmm. where a lot of ex-soap stars do that sort of thing, get paid for it.
Yes. Yeah, for them, it's like a massive step down in their career. For me, it's a massive step up in my career.
Just delicious. Back shortly. Welcome back. Brian O'Connell here. First Consignment, RTÉ's latest Doc on One series, concluded last weekend. The series tells a largely undocumented story of the first ever shipment of weapons from Libya to the Provisional IRA. In this clip, you'll hear narrator Liam O'Brien and a former IRA member detail how the South Tipperary IRA Brigade ran weapons training camps in the early 1970s.
The majority of the trainees who attended these weapons trainings were from the north of Ireland. And so Marcus and his comrades would provide safe accommodation, food and a training location. And of course, hands-on equipment. This was the early 1970s, a time when the IRA was largely reliant on donations of weapons from the general population to arm themselves.
Well, basically different type of weapons, like you had a mixture of everything, very old and very, not none of them very new in the beginning, like, you know, basically Thompson submachine gun, Sterling, the old 303, there was various type of the Mauser, the old 45s, you nearly beat a lot of days with them, then kill them with a bullet out of it. The activity was you were supposed to be able to break them down and put them back together, even in darkness. Then you'd be trained to shoot out the foresight and the backsight. But the basic principle of any gun is still the same, like, you know.
They'd usually hold weekend or week-long training camps, mostly around South Tipperary.
And it generally ended with either a fire-off of weapons of what they learned before you broke camp, and we'd fire-off then and dismantle straight away, so as that there wasn't many mobile phones at the time or anything, so you had at least a couple of hours to be gone and everything cleared up. So that's it.
The series also focused on the impact of the weapons shipment, including hearing from the families of victims. In this clip, Robert Keyes spoke about the day his father was killed.
On that morning that the Provisional IRA fired the RPG rocket at Bleak and murdered my father, they fired 15 RPG rockets at 10 different locations throughout Northern Ireland. 9 of those locations they claimed responsibility for. But such was the disgust in the whole community, Protestant and Roman Catholic, at the murder of my father. They did not claim responsibility for the attack on Bleak Police Station and never claimed responsibility for the murder of my father or tried to explain their reasons for that attack. The people that done that morning probably wanted to make me a victim, but I refused to be a victim because they're not going to destroy my life.
And that was First Consignment from RTÉ's Doc on One, now available to download as a podcast. Columnist and TV presenter Adrian Childs spoke with Oliver Callan this week, and often his writing finds meaning in the mundane, including humble household cutlery.
I did one about having a favourite spoon,
yes,
which I do have a favourite spoon, but it's for practical reasons with me. But then someone got in touch, so they said, well, I had a favourite spoon. It was the spoon my mother always served my food with, you know, growing up as a child. And when my mother died, I kept the spoon. And she said, there's so much love in that spoon. And I thought, well, actually, then a mere spoon is freighted with meaning. And if a mere spoon can be freighted with meaning, then anything can.
Inanimate objects. I love the fact that you're kind of rooting around in the drawer. You've 17 wooden spoons, but you'll always go towards the spoon
I
you love.
I get anxious if it's not there. I get that nagging feeling. Where is it? Has my wife thrown it away or something? What's happened? I get seized by panic, and then I find it. Sometimes it disappears for days on end, then I find it again. But, you know, it's yes.
You go from those issues to very, very serious topics, and people are extremely moved. And I found a very moving reading as well about your father's death.
He was very ill and very unhappy for a long time. And in the beginning of the last months, I was astonished by just how shocked I was, even though it was the least surprising thing ever. I mean, the sense I've got a couple of very close Irish friends. And, you know, as I said to them, and what I know through them is that you do death a lot better in Ireland. I mean, it was a Welsh woman who made the most sense to me. She read what I wrote about being with my dad, and she was a friend of mine, this woman, but my age, and knew my parents.
Yeah.
And she's a nurse, and she said to me, I was talking about how horrifying I found it to be with somebody who was dying, and she said, no, it's a privilege to be with somebody who's dying. And it was one of those thoughts that completely, I just realised I've been looking at everything through the wrong end of the telescope, or the wrong way round. You know, I just thought, yes, she's right.
Yeah.
And I sort of slightly beaten myself up. I thought, God, I wish I'd known that. I wish I'd thought that. I wish I could have just made 1% of it feel like a privilege. I would have made a better job of it.
Adrian Childs there speaking to Oliver Callan. Someone else who has mined personal experience for the benefit of his writing is Michael Harding. In his latest memoir, I Loved Him From the Day He Died, Harding explores the complexities of his relationship with his father. He spoke to Brendan O'Connor.
Memory is a kind of intimacy. And I found that is why I wrote memoirs. It was like coming to terms with my own life by remembering other people. And somebody said to me, you never talk about your father at all.
Yeah, like that's classically Irish.
Like 8 books and you never mention them. And then somebody else said to me one day about 3 years ago, they looked at me like as if they knew me in a different way. And I said, what are you looking at? And they said, I can see your father in you, totally, as you're getting older. And it frightened me. My father was a strange, remote island that I knew nothing about in one sense, because he was 50 when he married.
So did he play with you at all? When
no,
you were a child?
No. It's one of the things about him. You know, he lived, as far as I'm concerned, in an armchair underneath a standard lamp in the front room in the house. And the rest, I'd be in the back room, in the dining room, watching the television or talking to the mammy in the kitchen. But you'd nearly knock on the door going up to him, and he'd be in there reading a book or reading a kind of a journal. He used to love Hibernia and all them journals.
Yeah.
And he was like a space that you entered into. He was a mysterious space. He was like a novel that I hadn't read. He seemed content in himself. So what I'm saying is that I suppose to me he was like Those times he was authoritative, those times that you'd be scared of him. You know, when he died,
did you love him then?
I don't think I was capable of love. I don't think you're capable of love until you really begin to suffer and grow.
Yeah.
You know, like I was attached to him and he hugely helped me because he gave me space to be a writer. He encouraged me as a writer. You know, no matter what I wrote, I would write little poems which sometimes had very negative things about life in them, you know.
Yeah.
And he'd read the poem and he'd say, keep it up, yeah, it's good.
So he was proud of you, was he?
I think he was, but again, he died when I was 21 years of age, so I never had an adult conversation with him. I'd been away in college for 4 years, so I never knew him except as a teenager. And so all the times that you want to talk to your father when you're 25, when you're 35, when you're married, when you have children, and you'd love to ask him a question, or you'd love to ask him what his life was like.
Yeah.
You know, what was the 50 years like before he married? And what made him the kind of person he was? Because, like...
And then you go into that, because that's the question then. What made him like that? What happened to him?
And you speculate for years.
Yeah.
When he'd, you know, you'd kiss him goodnight sometimes, and he was an aged face with a kind of a beardy stubble, right? And it was like there was no intimacy, but there was no football, there was no playing games, there was no, like, he wasn't a warrior or a hero or somebody that you could be proud of in the way that young boys want to be proud of their fathers. The one thing he did was he created space. He was tolerant of you.
Okay.
You know, but he wasn't the kind of obvious sort of strong masculine father that people think a young boy needs as a template.
A revealing insight into Michael Harding's father was when he used to bring Michael's mom to visit relatives, except he often never left the car.
He was so kind of private in himself that when sometimes he'd bring my mother to different places. I mentioned one relation in the book, but there was loads of other places we'd go. And she'd be going to visit her sisters. She had four sisters in different parts of the country. And we'd go in and we'd meet the you know, the auntie and the cousins. But my father would very often stay in the car. He'd say, I'll be in later. He might have four Sunday newspapers. And then he'd have a book that he'd say, I'm reviewing this for David Marcus,
Yeah.
And he'd be in the car, you know, flittering away with the book or reading the newspapers. And eventually, like after maybe 2 or 3 hours, my aunt would say to me, mother, where's Michael? Bring him in. You know, he just wasn't sociable at that level, you know. And I had one uncle, it was great fun, but I had one uncle who used to always, he'd be in the bar, you know.
Yeah.
And he always called my father Mick, you know. I did a strong Dublin accent. He said, how are you, Mick? Well, you have a point. And I could see, even as a young fella, I could see my father just didn't like that kind of intimacy, right? So I think that I spent my life searching for a kind of a father model. I used to love, when I lived in rural Ireland, I used to love the kind of robust men that were maybe 20 years older than me, who had been in America and had big lives, and they were very abrasive and they could sing songs and they'd have another whiskey. And they were so different. They were so kind of masculine. It was the summer that my father died that I went back to Maynooth to start, you know, doing theology and thinking to be a priest.
Looking for another distant
looking
father.
For some sort of template of fatherhood.
Yeah.
And I think that all those ways are the ways that a father can leave you broken, no matter whether he's good or bad. It's really a very strong template in your
and you were broken,
in your psyche.
Were you?
I think I'm broken all the time. Yeah.
How much can we fully trust our memories? And to what extent do we self-edit memory to inform our identity? This was something Doctors Harry Barry and Anne-Marie Craven chatted to Claire Byrne about on Wednesday.
Having these experiences and recalling them, it allows us to have a narrative of our life story. And this explains to us who we are. So maybe we were someone who really enjoyed spending a lot of time on the beach in childhood, or maybe we didn't, okay? And we learned something about ourselves from that. So these experiences give us a sense of who we are, but they also allow us to update our sense of who we are as we meet new experiences.
You used the example of the beach. beach. And there was one day last summer, I remember, I took my children to the beach and they talk about, you know, they had a great time at that beach and they'd like to go back to that beach because it was such great fun. I remember I was perished. I was freezing. The sand was blowing in my eyes and all I could think about was getting the sand out of their shoes when we got home. So, you know, two people can have very different memories of a situation.
Absolutely. But suppose I absolutely hate hate the sand, hate the beach, don't want anything to do it. I have no memory of any of that nice thing. But what I really was disgusted about was those banana sandwiches from the old fashioned biscuit tin. And I can recall them myself and my mother pulling out these soggy sandwiches from the tin. And, you know, that might be your memory. And, you know, so your perceptions of that particular day might be totally different.
Harry, you've actually brought back nightmares for me there because I've forgotten banana sandwiches existed, so my children mightn't thank you for this idea.
Doctors Harry Barry and Anne-Marie Creven speaking to Claire Byrne about the reliability of memory and soggy sandwiches. Now, to a European crisis brewing of a very different kind. The whimsical Netflix series Emily in Paris revealed at the end of season 4 that lead character Emily was headed for Rome. Mais pourquoi, I hear you say. Well, French President Emmanuel Macron said non, as Drive Time reported.
We will fight hard and we will ask them to remain. Emily in Paris in Roma doesn't make sense.
There you go. International relations. That's Emmanuel Macron of France. Well, one Italian man who says Emily should stay in Rome is Giuseppe Crupi, director of Pinocchio Cookery School in Dublin. Buonasera.
Ciao bello, come stai?
Do you like Emily in Paris, Giuseppe?
I did to a point. All it was missing was the location. Now it's going to be perfect.
Do you think Emily in Roma will be better?
French people generally hate to lose, but they hate it more if they lose against Italians.
Yeah, and Italians love to win.
Especially against the French.
How and ever is in Paris far more elegant and fashion conscious. And isn't the food far better in Paris than it would be in Roma? Giuseppe.
Giuseppe, never mind.
Prego,
Giuseppe.
Sarah, prego.
Okay. No, thank you, thank you. And I feel provoked that I learned.
Shocked.
I learned to shut my inner demons. And I see there a challenge, you know, like for you to get out of the blindness and the darkness of your ignorance. So basically.
You're saying Paris is for today, but Rome is forever, I think, is basically what you're saying.
It's a good way. I think Netflix should use that.
Giuseppe, grazie, arrivederci. Thank you very much indeed. Giuseppe Crupi, director of Pinocchio Cookery School in Dublin.
Cormac and Sarah doing their best to ignite a diplomatic feud. Back shortly, mon ami. Welcome back. Brian O'Connell here. Now, who knew the closure of a chip shop in Cork could get so much attention? Jackie Lennox's is as Cork as Tanora and Jimmy Barry Murphy. And after over 70 years in business, it was time to batter their last sausage, as Ginny O'Sullivan reported on Morning Ireland.
Next, please.
The doors of Jackie Lennox's takeaway opened at midday yesterday. 9 hours later, extended family and staff were still taking orders. After a week which saw thousands of people come through the front door to say thanks and place a last order.
We'll miss you so much.
That's your granny behind the counter.
Yeah, it's so nice to see her back there. She's in her element, but she's obviously so upset.
Among the final customers last night was Cork GAA legend Niall Cahalan.
Yeah, I've been probably here once a week, too often. You see the size of me.
We said we'd come up just to see the clothes, you know, just support them. They've been fantastic to us.
It is very emotional to say goodbye to them all, because they're lovely as well, like, you know.
Well, inside it was time for photographs before the lights dimmed and a final round of goodbyes and cheers reduced Frances Lennox and her granddaughter Ella to tears.
Can you believe it's all over?
No, not really. It's been like my whole childhood being up here with my granny. Like you can see today, my whole family's here. It's just really sad to see it go.
I mean, to see the crowds in the last 4 days, it was strange. I've never in my life come across the emotions that I have in me. I mean, standing in the storm, they were. And for 4 hours to say thank you. I never in my life thought that this guy who just works in a chip shop would be you know, so well respected. I'll be here till 3 or 4 in the morning. But that's my life. I've always done that. So people have asked me to go for a drink and all that. But it's a cup of tea at the end of the night. It's my, that's my little portion. So I'm looking forward to that tonight. Bathe my feet and have a nice cup of tea.
Brian Lennox there, ending Jenny O'Sullivan's report from Morning Ireland. Staying in the real capital, one of their most famous adopted sons, Rory Gallagher, is to be remembered at 2 gigs next summer at the Marquee. And guitar legend Joe Bonamassa and Rory Gallagher's brother, Donal, were on with Miriam to talk about the gigs, and the interview began with some high praise from Donal about Joe.
Joe Bonamassa is right now probably one of the greatest name in guitar playing. To me, a parallel with Rory, the same ethos and love of music. And I would kind of describe both Joe and Rory, as having watched their careers being students who become the masters.
Thank you very much. It means a lot to me.
And when did you first become aware of Donal, who's beside you, his brother Rory Gallagher?
I was introduced to Donal through my ex-girlfriend.
Okay.
Sandy Tom. And this was probably 12 years ago, 13 years ago. And she goes, I have a surprise for you. I was playing the Hammersmith Odeon. And I have a surprise for you. And the next thing I know, she lets out that, like, you know, Donal Gallagher is coming down and he's bringing something. And I'm like, oh, my God, I think I can guess what it is. And you showed up with your son, Daniel, and out of this little gig bag that said Fender on it, comes out the iconic guitar that, you know, I would look at pictures of, you know, in books and on record and magazines, and it's in my hands. And he's like, you can play it if you want. And I'm like, very few instruments go from being a guitar, because when Leo Fender's company made it in 1961, it was a Sunburst Stratocaster. And they made a lot of Sunburst Stratocasters that somehow in its journey from Fullerton, California, ended up at Crowley's Music in Cork. And, you know, Lord knows how it made it there, but it made it there. And Rory bonded with that one probably more than any of the guitars that he owned. And he had a lot of instruments. Very few instruments go from being a guitar to a cymbal.
Rory's famous 1961 Strat is soon to be auctioned with an estimate of over 1 million euro. There are calls, though, for it to remain in Ireland.
After numerous years of trying to find a home, and I don't want to be pointing fingers at any institutions, or and my dealings with institutions have led to a certain frustration. We're all on the conveyor belt of life, and you sort of, without being morbid about it, and I was very ill for a couple of years. In recent times, I've recovered. So and all these decisions come into, and we're talking about a store full of stuff. I know we're speaking about the guitar, but it's his collection of instruments. And like Joe, who's an amazing collector, it's a very hard decision. I put it to my family, particularly the boys who can play guitar. In the end, the insurance, the cost, the only way was to put them in a bank vault.
And I know you feel very strongly, Joe, you're a collector, but that this guitar should stay in Ireland, don't you?
I've been saying since day one, when Donal and the family announced the auction, as one of the bigger guitar collectors in the world, my phone had about 150 text messages from my friends and colleagues and collectors and people who are trying to spend my money. And my initial reaction was, that guitar doesn't, it can't leave Ireland. Yeah. It doesn't feel right for me. Whoever buys it has to be very sensitive to that. You know, I really hope, I was even going to try to reach out to that Irish guy in Lion's Den and be like, come on, man, you got 9 figures before the decimal point. Put up some money, man. You know, let's do it right.
It should be here in one of our museums. That's what it should be. But that's for another day, Donal. You and I could talk forever on that.
John Creedon also got in on the act and disclosed his own Rory Gallagher links on Monday night.
They were all in town, Donal Gallagher and Jerry McAvoy, bass player. I can just see him at the City Hall. 1974, is it that long ago, is it? My God, 1974. I'm actually on that album, as it turns out. I'm the kid who's screeching in the background. But anyway, here is Joel Bonamassa and his band with Rory Gallagher's Cradle Rock, which indeed is the opening track on the Irish Tour 74 album. Anyway, we're going to give you that.
If you thought there was no sex in Ireland until the Late Late Show, well, Miles Dungan has some news for you.
Now we're looking at the complex history of sex and Christianity. The new book, Lower Than the Angels, is a historical exploration of the religion's complex relationship with gender, sex and sexuality.
Ah, now, sex and Christianity. Yeah, what, gay? Oxford historian, author and church organist Dermot McCullough saw to reframe the narrative around sex and Christianity and the role of marriage with Miles on The History Show.
When I was a boy, long ago, there was a popular song, Love and Marriage Go Together Like Horse and Carriage. That really isn't the case historically. These are two different things, and we now try and associate them in marriages, often with not terribly good results. I'm not saying it was a bad idea that marriage was once family alliance. It was a different way of doing marriage, and it involved different assumptions about what marriage is.
And you also point out that for centuries, the church regarded marriage as a less valid option.
Yeah, it was messy. It was to do with sex and physicality. And that really wasn't the church's business. I mean, the killer fact about that is that in the early church, the church of the first five centuries or so, there was no such thing as a wedding in church. We think of confetti and bells or whatever. That simply didn't happen. That's something which gradually crept into the church, starting in the 5th century.
Now, apparently celibacy is only a 1,000-year project and is related really to property, to church property.
Celibacy became a unique project within this Western church. There had been celibacy from the early days of the church, and the development of monasteries and monks and nuns within the church, which is a sort of 2nd century of the Christian era phenomenon. That's one thing. But in the 11th and 12th century, the Western Church, the Church of the Pope, did something that no other church in history has ever tried, and that is to make all the clergy of the church celibate. Most clergy before that would be married. The celibate clergy won.
Tell me about the 18th century Russian Orthodox peasant prophet Kondraty Selivanov.
Yes, he was a rather familiar figure in Russian Orthodoxy, a wandering mystic who looked at the Bible intensely in his own way. Unfortunately, he misread bits of the Bible. Where the text says, be fruitful, he read, castrate yourselves. But that's one of the extreme examples of what happens if you intensely look at the Bible, probably in the wrong way.
Careful reading those Bibles now. If you happen to be married or dating and are looking for ideas to help reignite the spark, you could try romantic dinners at home. But put away the frozen pizza and start chilling your glasses, as Lily Higgins told Brendan. Actually, one sec, let me just set the mood.
It's just not enough. Oh, oh, man. My darling, I can't get enough of your love, man.
That's it. Now, Lily, take it away.
you know, you don't have time to sort of start a new delicious recipe when, you know, everyone's running in and out.
So you have two alternative ideas. One is that if dinner time doesn't work for a little mum and dad time or alone time, that you could go for a nice brunch time kind of date.
Love
in the afternoon kind of thing, if you want
Exactly. So say usually now on a Sunday morning, you know, the kids are delighted, they're big into their gaming and stuff like that. You know, they might be doing some sort of event online and that's ideal. So we just take that time, that few hours to just make a pot of coffee. I love just, you know, nice granola and yogurt and fruit and just take a bit of time. Stuff that I wouldn't do midweek. Yeah.
OK, so look, if you're going to go the full Monty then and have date night dinner and make things a little bit special, a few elements to make it a little bit special. You've one genius idea here. So simple, but chilling glasses. It really is one of life's little luxuries, isn't it? A glass out of the freezer.
Yeah, it really is. So you just have your glasses in the freezer and just, I always have loads of ice as well. I just love it. And I don't know what the difference is between just, you know, tap water straight from the tap or else like a jug of water with ice and slices of lemon and your chill glasses. And it just, you know what, it just tells the other person, like, I've thought ahead, I've planned this. This is a lovely moment. And, you know, you just enjoy your drink a little bit more and you relax a bit. Lighting candles in the house are just lovely. You know, in the middle of the table, it just marks it as a moment and as an occasion. We're all going to sit down and chat. And you tend to sort of stay at the table a little bit longer as well if there's a candle lighting. You know, it's like having a fire, isn't it? You know, you're
kind of around
the candle, you're kind of chatting and the kids kind of tend to drift off. So
for a main course, you are suggesting the very appropriate Marry Me Chicken, to which they will say, I did, like, and this is how my life has turned out. We're having date night at the kitchen table.
Exactly. This is why I married a hun. This is why I married a So it's actually a really good one for doing the slow cooker as well. And I've given you the full recipe for that as well. It's really easy. So, and kids love it as well. Like, do you know what I think is a really good thing to
forget the kids. Forget the kids. The kids get all the rest of the time. Don't forget them. Come here. Are we going to chance having a cocktail or is that ill-advised? What do you think?
I mean, I've done it, you know, and you see what happens is I tend to not really care then about the dinner.
Yes,
you know, once you've had a second cocktail, you think,
definitely. You're not eating at that point, are you?
No, you're in it. So then that's when you take out a block of cheese and crackers and you say, like, this is lovely. This is perfect. I've had a night like this in ages.
I have a feeling these home date nights could catch on. And now for some musical marmite, perhaps. Anyone who follows James Blunt on social media will know he's as self-deprecating as they come. But speaking to Oliver Callan on Wednesday, 20 years on from the release of his seminal album Back to Bedlam, Blunt began in a more thoughtful mood.
The music business is a fickle and a shallow one. It's not even about music. It's not about what's hip and what's cool and of the moment. I feel very lucky. And I feel I travel the world and I sing in English, but I sing to people who speak any number of languages with any colour of skin or race or religion. And yet they come, stand shoulder to shoulder and feel the same human emotion that I'm singing about. And so while our politicians try and divide us, I feel very much that all humans, we share the same human emotion. And I think we're much more alike than our politicians or our flag wavers would necessarily tell us.
Also, I think your fans and even people who wouldn't call themselves your fans love that unique way you have of dealing with what you say, to turn that negativity into a positive. And as part of the strategy for the anniversary, you've offered to change your name.
Yeah, well, that was very silly of me. I'd said if the album gets to number one, I would change my name to whatever the public chose. And I misjudged the public.
The reaction has been quite
strong. Would not be a good name.
What is currently one of the front runners that you might have to leave?
I mean, it's so obvious. I'm so sad about it. It's like Blunty McBluntface.
Yeah, that's a kind of a boring one, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, my children were rather excited by Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Pop Star 4-chord Song Machine.
One Hit Wonder, I think, is another one.
No, Jimmy Spliff seems to be high. I wish I could. I might stick with that. If that one, I would probably keep that.
And as well as being a chart-topping singer, James Blunt is also a pub landlord and puts his own music to good use at closing time.
Reading this week in the New York Times, or you're chatting to them, you own a pub in Chelsea in London. People know that. It's called The Fox and the Pheasant. Tell us how you make sure everyone leaves at closing time.
Yeah, well, we have strict licensing law at the Fox and Pheasant, which specifically no music by James Blunt. That's what the council actually said. I think the neighbours demanded that when I bought the pub, apart from at 5 to midnight, which is closing time, I am then allowed to play You're Beautiful to help clear the pub out.
And it works. It works.
It's a very efficient.
It wouldn't work here, just so you know. Nothing works here.
And it's time for me to end this week's show. There's only one way to do it, really. Till next time. Take it away, Blunty.
My life is brilliant. My love is pure.